It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. The city of Seattle has just passed a new head tax on businesses. Some of the money will pay for homeless services, but most of the money will pay for building about 600 units of affordable housing over 5 years. 600 units, that's a fraction of the demand for cheaper housing. If you really want to lower home prices, says the Chamber of Commerce, Seattle needs to build upward. We are a city zoned mostly for single-family houses. The Chamber says we need to let developers turn craftsmen into apartments, condos, townhomes. But wait, is that the city we want? Would that be the city we love? Here with two different points of view, we have Roger Valdez. Roger, will you remind me how I should identify your work?
I'm the director of Seattle for Growth.
Director of Seattle for Growth. You're in favor of upzoning, being less of a single-family housing town.
Right. And we're a housing advocacy organization, all kinds of housing everywhere for people of all levels of income.
All kinds of housing everywhere. Susanna Lynn, welcome.
Hi.
You live in Wallingford?
I do.
And you are against this idea of upzoning, significantly upzoning Seattle.
Yes, I don't think the plan will work to make Seattle more affordable.
So let's begin. You live in Wallingford, as I said. Roger, let's say I used to date somebody in Wallingford. I can picture it. some relatively quiet streets and lawns and rhododendrons in the front yard. She happened to have a driveway, but I guess I don't know if all homes do. But I can picture this single family Seattle neighborhood. Roger, what do you said housing everywhere? What do you want that area of Wallingford I'm picturing? How do you want Susanna's neighborhood to be like?
Well, I think it ought to be determined by the property owners and the people that live there and the people that want to live there. So I don't necessarily want to see the neighborhood change overnight, but I think property owners, single-family homeowners, should be able to create, you know, a backyard cottage or create a duplex or a triplex and allow more people to live in Wallingford. I think if you keep it single-family, it means that you've got you create scarcity and only a certain number of people can live there. So my point is not so much, you know, wipe out the single-family, but give the single-family homeowners more options to build on their own property.
So, Susanna, imagine those backyard cottages and duplexes and triplexes on your Wallingford street. What would that do to your neighborhood, in your opinion?
So I have no problem with backyard cottages. I think they're a great way to add a little density. And as far as duplexes and triplexes go, the concern is what would that look like as far as setbacks and a lot of the properties we see now that are multifamily take up a lot more room. But a lot of what I'm getting at is that I don't think this is going to help the affordability. And I also think that there's plenty of room right now with our current zoning. And so first use the room we have, which is 2 to 3 times what we need to build the housing that we're projected to need. So first use that current zoning that we have and that the neighborhood has planned, in our old neighborhood plans as to where the density would fit best.
Okay, so those are two arguments. Let's break those down. First of all, you said you don't believe that building more, that upzoning Seattle and building more units would make housing more affordable. I remember Econ 101, the more supply there is, the cheaper it gets. Why do you say that wouldn't happen in Seattle?
Okay, so real life is rarely textbook.
Yes.
Yes. So let's take a look at some place like the Central District. Okay, the Central District is a historically black neighborhood with, historically people who might not be as wealthy as other neighborhoods. And part of the argument with the upzoning is that increased density is going to make it cheaper. So the Central District has had a lot of increased density, but what is happening is they're increased luxury units, and the most affordable units is what is being torn down first.
Okay.
And so, it's not helping. The increased density we see in the Central District is not helping people of color or poorer communities thrive.
Roger, if the new housing units are fancy and expensive, how does that make housing cheaper?
Well, that's just not true. I mean, there's something called the skew of the new. So when, just like buying a new car is more expensive than buying a used car. So when we build new housing, that new housing is more expensive because it's new. But overall, If we create more, and we've seen it in New York right now where there's a drop in rents because there's an abundance of supply. When there's scarcity, prices go up. The data shows over years that for about 40,000 units created over a 20-year period, there were only about, I think it was 5,000 demolitions. So we're creating a 8-to-1 ratio of new housing to housings that we're knocking down. And so if you knock down an older single-family house in a low-rise zone and build 40 units or 50 units, the net value to the community exceeds the loss of that one unit. So overall, what we're seeing is more supply means lower prices, and it means more access to housing for all kinds of people.
Okay, so that's a fundamental disagreement that we're not going to convince listeners of one way or the other sitting here in a studio, but that's there's a framed debate for you. Would more housing make units cheaper? And we don't have agreement on that. We have an email from a KUOW listener named Tom in Finney Ridge. And Tom writes, by the way, our email address is record@kuow.org. Tom in Finney Ridge writes, if the council decides to pack the neighborhoods and remove yards where kids can play and plants can flourish, we might as well be Manhattan with all its attendant issues. Short answer is, says Tom, saving the neighborhoods is key to saving the city, because when, not if, the crash comes, all those ugly square buildings that have replaced the houses and yards will be vacant, and there will be no coming back to where we were or are now. Roger, how do you answer that?
Well, we're a city. So, you know, if you want to live in, you know, Mount Vernon, then move to Mount Vernon. We're going to have issues. And the fact is that as a city that's growing, we're going to have more diversity. We're going to have more complex issues as when you've got more people in the same place.
But we don't have to, right? I mean, we could vote to preserve the Seattle exactly like some people love it. Maybe
came here. Well, but we have a city council that talks out of both sides of its mouth. On the one hand, it talks about sustainability and density and benefit to the environment from living in a more dense, compact, walkable environment. But then they do things to undermine that with their policy to make it harder to build. So sure, put it on the ballot, you know, pull up the drawbridge and shut down the city and don't let anybody else come in. If people vote for that, I guess that's what we'll have. But what's happening is you have a council that's essentially creating policy that does that, but then they're saying, oh, well, we want to create an affordable city. So the fact is you can't have it both ways. Our council wants to do both things. They want to satisfy neighbors that don't want growth, like the guy that wrote in. But then at the same time, they say, oh, we want affordability. You can't do both things.
Okay, Susanna, Roger just said, basically, if you want to be Mount Vernon, go somewhere else. Seattle is a changing city. What do you say to that?
So I've lived in New York City. I was 18 and rented a very, very small micro apartment. And now that I have a family and have children, I have a small single family home. As we grow, our needs, as we, you know, age in our life, our needs change. And so I think it's important that we create space for everyone, and that includes families. We have room to grow in our current zoning. But if we decrease the single family zoning, then we will decrease the supply of the single family homes. We don't have to do that in order to increase multifamily zoning. I moved to Seattle because it is a more livable city than New York. I wanted a home in the city. It doesn't have to be Manhattan. There is some middle ground. There is middle ground between Manhattan and, you know, the boondoggles.
So. Well, I mean, Bill, the thing is that with all respect to Susanna, I mean, her folks shut down single family in single family. A few years back, Tim Burgess led a charge along with Mike O'Brien to kill small lot development in single family zones. In other words, smaller homes. So the folks that are now advocating the things that that Susanna's group is advocating killed single family development in single family zones. So, you know, and she says she wants backyard cottages. Well, they've appealed that and shut that down.
Okay.
Ryan, you know, so the point is you can't say well, we want more single-family homes, but then kill the ability to build more single-family homes.
Susanna, do you want more single-family? Do you want a more density of single-family homes?
No, I'm not saying that we need to increase single-family. I'm just saying it.
So are you in favor of small-lot development on small lots?
Well, I would
prefer 2,500 square foot with setbacks, 5 feet each side, front yard, backyard.
Okay, I'd like to hear her answer.
Okay, so one, I wasn't part of killing any backyard cottages, and the appeal to the backyard cottages was not to kill it. It was to make the city actually study the impacts of their legislation, which was pretty far-reaching. So, and then secondly, you know, in the Wallingford Urban Village, for example, all of the single-family zoning is set to go to low-rise zone, not to residential small lot. Now, I think a lot of people in Wallingford would prefer, if they did have to have a up zone, for it to go to residential small lot versus low-rise.
I want to get at Susanna's second argument. We already talked about whether more building would make housing cheaper. Your second argument was that we already have room to grow. So, Roger, could we not build more units in the multifamily zones that we already have? Maybe that's build higher, build taller, single-family neighborhoods alone. Do you agree that we could build more if we wanted to?
I think we could, but what's interesting is that the single-family neighbors have, through the Mike O'Brien's efforts and the council, him listening to them, have created more and more regulations in multifamily zones. So what you've had is single-family neighbors killing off the ability to build single-family homes in single-family zones. Then they've kind of come out of their zones and killed micro-housing, which is where I live, a very small unit. Then they've gone after low-rise, which is the apartments, and forced setbacks and a whole bunch of other requirements. So, again, what we have is we have people saying, well, we want single-family zones, single-family housing, but then they've stopped single-family development in single-family zones, and then they've said, well, grow where we can, but then they've put in setbacks.
So the city could do its growing in existing multifamily zoned areas, but
right.
It's just hard to do.
And so Norm Rice, and back in 20 years ago when they did the comp plan, the original grand bargain was with neighborhoods and said exactly what we're getting to, which is we'll leave single family zones alone, but we're going to grow bigger, higher, denser in urban villages. But the problem is that the neighbors come out of the woodwork and kill dense development in the urban villages as well. So what we have is we have a situation.
For the record, Susanna is in favor of denser development in the currently multifamily zone area.
Will you support the abolition of design review?
I think design review is a very important process.
Well, that kills projects, drives up costs.
Why does design review kill projects?
It costs a lot of money. For example, I just got a hearings examiner appeal from neighbors that appealed a project that was a rezone to go higher in multifamily zones. It went through three iterations of design review. That's hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But don't we have that? Things we want cost money, but don't we have design review in order to have the kind of, if we're going to have building, it should be the kind that we want?
Well, do we want to add $100 a month to rent for the color of the Hardy panel on a building?
The design reviews is an important process. These buildings will be there for a long time. I've been to plenty of design reviews. The design reviews I've been to say things like there was a backyard cottage next to this multifamily home, and they were going to build the building so close to the property line that the backyard cottage wouldn't be able to open its windows. The backyard cottage, they were going to put the trash bins right outside the window of the backyard cottage. These things come up at design review, and they might not be noticed otherwise. It's an important, these buildings will be there for a long time. I'm not saying that there's not ways to create more affordability by making the process better. That could be part of it, but I don't think we should kill design review.
Susanna Lynn isn't your group called Seattle Fair Growth?
Yeah, so we're Seattle Fair Growth.
Yes, Roger Valdez, Seattle for Growth. And we're debating whether Seattle ought to upzone itself, be less of a single family neighborhood town. Roger, you mentioned the color of a Hardy panel, the design review adding to the cost of units. But couldn't that be an important compromise? One thing I'm pretty sure I heard you use the word ugly, or boxy or something, but I often hear this as a critique of increased development, is it's not just that you get more housing, you get ugly, boxy housing, looks soulless. I get emails like this all the time. Isn't there an area to improve that?
You know, somebody hearing my voice right now is wondering, how am I going to make my rent payment in June? Do I have that extra $100? Is it worth it to have a pretty building that Susanna and her neighbors approved 5 years ago? Are you willing to pay an extra $100 a month for that? I don't think so.
Susanna?
So I would like to argue that rents will be charged according to what the market will allow. The landlords will charge as high of a rent as they can in most cases to make their profits. I don't think so. What we could be cutting into is maybe the profits of the developers, the profit margin, but I don't think it's going to change the rent. I think that's based on the market.
Let's talk about, you know, Roger said basically if you don't like a denser Seattle, move on. We're a changing, densifying city. Roger, couldn't I put the same question to you? If Seattle's getting unaffordable, if you think it's unaffordable, then you commute in. You know, you can't afford to live in Seattle. That happens. Isn't that just as
well? I
fair
mean,
to
I think
say?
I think you know if you accept the basic principle of supply and demand, I mean that drives the whole conversation. And when people get here and they have theirs and they have their own little plot of land, and they don't want anybody else to come in. I mean, and that's essentially what we're seeing. Is you've got people that are saying, I'm happy, I like what we've got right now, I don't want it to change, and so it should just stay exactly the way it is. And I think that the problem is you have politicians at City Hall and the City Council that want to satisfy that urge that people have, like, hey, it's really nice, and I understand that. But the fact is that if we had real leadership at City Hall, they'd say, folks, things are going to change, not like overnight, but little by little, the city's going to grow and evolve and change. And that might make you uncomfortable. And it might be that you have to pay a little more, or there's going to be some things you don't like down the road or that look ugly to you, but that are going to house people and give people a place to live so they can be part of our city.
Suzanne, I know you don't accept that more building is necessarily going to make it cheaper to live here, but some people do. And if you did, would you be willing? Would you say, you know, I might not like it, I might not like everything about it, but we want a whole range of people to be able to live in Seattle, including people who, you know, are teachers here or landscapers here or whatever it is. And so let's compromise. It may not be the city that it used to be.
You know, I would love to have more affordable housing buildings in Wallingford, and I think most of us in Wallingford would. I think it's important that we make the difference, notice the difference between more housing and more affordable housing. It's not the same thing. I don't believe it is at all. I believe that we should be building more subsidized housing. We also need to address, you know, people's immediate needs for sure. But I think without more permanently affordable housing, that's what we need. And we need to look at ways to fund that. But talking about the ways to fund it gets to a point that Roger and I agree on. We've been talking a lot about what we don't agree on, but we both agree that the city's plan right now, MHA mandatory housing affordability, is not the way to get the funding for that affordable housing. MHA exchanges up zones for the developers would have to include affordable units in their buildings or pay an in lieu fee.
Yeah. And can I talk about the numbers about that? You know, this is the classic definition. If you go to Wikipedia or your Google and look up the word boondoggle, mandatory housing affordability is a boondoggle, big time. They're saying they want 6,000 units by 2025 for $450 million. That would be about $75,000 a unit. The real cost of building an affordable unit right now is about $325,000. So they're underestimating the cost of building those affordable units for fees taken out of market rate development by about, you know, four times. And assuming that we were able to build it for $225 or less than that, you would have to build 1,000 units a year. The height of a nonprofit development about 5 years ago was 450 units a year.
So what do you recommend based on that?
Well, what we should be doing is helping people pay their rent. You know, Lorena Gonzalez keeps walking around citing old, defunct census numbers of 29,000 cost-burdened households at 30% of AMI below. In other words, someone that makes about $22,000 is paying $900 a month in rent. They should be paying about $550. That's $350 a month that they're short. Let's go ahead and tax ourselves $100 million a year. We can pay $300 a month to each of those 29,000 households and eliminate all that cost burden. So if we just paid people's rent, they're already housed, right? They're already living somewhere and they're struggling to pay the rent. We could solve that problem with $100 million a year. So this notion that you know, Lorena Gonzalez says, well, we got 29,000 households that are in trouble, therefore I want $75 million to build 1,780 homes. That's mm-hmm. what the head tax does, or less than that even now. So the problem is that the people at City Hall can't use a calculator, and they keep on saying, we're going to solve this problem by building units, and yet they state the problem as 29,000 cost burden households, but they're only going to build, you said it, I think 150 units a year?
I think new construction is around 600.
Over 6 years.
Units.
Over 5 years.
Yeah. Over 5 years. Anything to add to that, Susanna?
Yeah, so I think it is important to include immediate solutions, such as helping people with the rent and shelters and those sort of things. But I do believe that we have to have more permanently affordable housing, more subsidized housing, in order to really stop this freight train of this affordability crisis and all the homelessness increasing.
Where are we going to put 1,000 units? I mean, they're going to have to go in Wallingford.
We would be happy to have them in Wallingford. Wallingford
where will
is
they
not
go?
Wallingford, we have zoning capacity. Now,
for 1,000 units?
Obviously not all 1,000 units are going to end up in Wallingford.
That's 1,000 units a year.
I'd like to talk about the financing a little bit because we were talking about taxes. So, increasing property taxes has been also increasing the price of housing, and there are other options out there. We used to have something called a growth increment fund, and what this is as the economy grows, a portion of the new tax revenue that is generated from the growth of the economy is dedicated to affordable housing, say 20% of the new tax revenue from the growth of the economy. Growth increment fund is something we used to have in downtown. For some reason, they decided to stop it. But this is one source where you could get new tax revenue without having to increase property taxes. Those increases in property taxes are often passed down to the from landlords to tenants, so it increases everybody's housing costs.
Susanna Lynn and Roger Valdez, you can see that digital clock right up there next to you?
Yes.
Yeah, that says 1 minute left. So okay. It's time for me to say goodbye. Thank you for having this conversation with
Thank
us.
You.
We'll have more, but this Good. Is, you know, the premise was Seattle is passing this head tax. Some of it's going to pay for affordable housing units. But the question is, does the city need to do more than that to create more housing units? And we've been disagreeing over whether that would make Seattle a cheaper place to live and how would it affect the city we love. And we've been talking with Roger Valdez, who is with he advocates for more growth. Seattle for Growth is his organization. Susanna Lynn, her group is called Seattle Fair Growth. And that's what it's coming down to. What's the fair way to do this in the city we love? Thank you both.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW, and we'll be right back.